This is a Mentioning Liz podcast from mentioningliz.com. The famous Woodstock Music Festival celebrated its 40th anniversary in August 2009. The film Taking Woodstock, Destino Woodstock in Spanish, directed by Ang Lee, was also released in 2009. What was so special about those 3 days of peace and music more than 40 years ago? Before you listen to some of the people involved in the festival, let's practice some vocabulary. Listen and repeat. Escenario. Stage. Stage. Corso intensivo. Crash course. Crash course. Refugio. Shelter. Shelter. Justificar. Consentir. To condone. To condone. Rugido. Clamor. Roar. Roar. Actuación. Gig. Gig. Público. Audience. Audience. Gran oportunidad. Big break. Big break. Lucha. Struggle. Struggle. Abrazar, to hug, to hug. Derrumbarse, desmoronarse, to collapse, to collapse.
The name Woodstock is an accident. We didn't call it Woodstock, it just became known as that.
So it was really just an exposition of the arts. From the way the site was prepared to the fact that anybody who came would be welcome if you didn't have a ticket, if you didn't have any money. There was free kitchens, there was a free stage, there was free camping.
The media, the culture, everything was dominated by the establishment. And you got the feeling that you were alone in your thoughts, or maybe there were a few like you. And all of a sudden, in August of 1969, there were millions like you. And for the first time, people thought, we are not just a little counterculture. We're not just isolated others. We're a whole movement. And that became a generation.
Producers Joel Rosenman and Michael Lang had very little experience in planning a festival. Woodstock became their crash course in organizing.
It was a shock to all of us when Tuesday, before the festival, 50,000 people arrived just to get good seats. That was our maximum, and they arrived 3 days in advance.
Joel Rosenman.
You need sanitation. You need health. You need roads, transportation. You need security. You need shelter. You need food. The needs are the same as they would be for any city. In fact, population-wise, Woodstock at the festival was the third largest city in New York State that weekend.
Coming in from London, from over the pole, flying in a bit.
It was the first American People's Festival.
Singer and songwriter Richie Havens opened the festival on Friday, August 15th, 1969.
It really brought together sharing, I would say, you know, sharing all ages, all influences. I knew the world had changed when, in the movie, the New York Times guy is interviewing the policeman standing there, and he's saying, hey, you're an officer around here. What do you think of all of this stuff? He says, what's there to think about? They're having a good time, you know?
reasons.
You mean you condone stuff like this? He says, what do I have to condone? My daughter's out there, Jess. The interesting thing was when he said, but you're a policeman. He said, no. I'm chief of police. That one sentence was the glue that brought out our arc. You know, we went from us to all of those people who say, what are you scared of them or what? You know, leave them alone. They're having a good time.
Freedom, freedom, freedom.
Two members of Sly and the Family Stone tell us about their show at Woodstock.
When we got there to play at Woodstock, we arrived by helicopter. It was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Singer and keyboardist Rose Stone.
And so, it was dark. So by the time we went on, it was still dark. And we went on right after Janis Joplin. We played and we played and we were playing a very long time. And all of a sudden, the sunrise started to come up. There was just people everywhere. You couldn't see land. And that, everybody kind of took a step back like, whoa, we didn't realize that many people were out there.
You can make it if you try. You can make it if you try.
Bassist and singer Larry Graham.
And so we do this run of music. And it's building and it's building and it's building. And finally, we come to the conclusion. And the response from the audience was something like I have never heard or felt in my life. It was just this roar from this sea of humanity that's coming at us like full force.
Nobody knew, of course, that the Woodstock would turn into what Woodstock has turned into.
Keyboardist and singer Rose Stone.
It was just another gig that we thought we were going to. But it turned out to be, of course, much more than that. An historic event.
Bassist Larry Graham.
The camaraderie of musicians that was going on backstage was just incredible. Everybody was just, it was just like we were in different bands, but it was all one big band, just segments of it going on at different times. But everybody had the same love, and everybody's hoping that the other person is successful. Everybody's happy that you just came off and your show was just slamming. The type of music that everybody was playing was conducive to love and peace and unity. And so, you know, we were feeding off each other, the audience with the band with the audience. And so backstage, all the bands had that same desire, had the same, they all wanted to go out there and spread the love.
Many groups got their big break at Woodstock. Santana was one of them.
Yeah, Santana was a surprise to everybody.
Woodstock producer Michael Lang.
You know, it was one of those moments when you know a star is being born. I mean, you could just see it. You could see the reaction in the audience, and it just out of left field because there wasn't a lot of Latin rock around then. The performance was amazing. You just knew that this band was going to be around for a long, long time.
Guitarist Carlos Santana.
Some people would prefer for me just to shut up and play the music. I can only express what's in me, and it turns me on to turn people on into their own light. I've been doing this since 64, 67, with the music in my aspirations. We are multidimensional warriors. We are assigned and designed to utilize what God gave us to ignite, integrate, infuse, and rearrange humans so they can claim, we can claim, what is already ours, the light.
What was happening in the 60s, especially as far as the younger people were concerned, there was a lot of tension. There was the Vietnam War going on. There was the struggle for human rights, you know, for African Americans and for women and for poor people. It was a time of great upheaval.
Graham Nash.
And what the singer-songwriters were doing were reacting to the headlines in the newspaper and the headlines on the news. And that became part of what we wrote about because it was happening to us as people. I mean, there was a lot to write about. And we just were there at a time with an art form in our hands and our hearts. And we utilized it to the best way that we knew.
Take a sister, then father.
Singer and songwriter Country Joe McDonald.
Well, I never saw one fight or a real argument over anything in those 3 days. And everyone helped everyone else. At one point, in front of the stage, two guys got up and started to have a fight with each other. And the crowd separated, so they cleared a little space out so they could do it, you know. Then the crowd began saying, "Don't do that, cool out." And then the guys cooled out and hugged each other, you know, and everyone ran around hugging each other and saying, "Oh, I'm sorry," and stuff like that. And then they all sat down, you know. Well, yeah, that's not normal behavior at a rock concert.
At Woodstock, Country Joe McDonald had a sing-along with almost 500,000 people.
I was sort of an act of faith to relate to it as an audience. I mean, with kind of an echo delay or something on their response. You heard it, but as a kind of a disconnected roar or something. And that's why I'm fixing it to Iraq. I implored the audience to sing louder because I couldn't hear them.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam.
Woodstock was a grandiose example of hippie counterculture ideals, but Ritchie Havens watched them work on a smaller scale too.
They had such a wonderful sense of caring for other people. They had free stores. You could walk in if you need a coat in the winter. You walk in, you take one, you leave. And these guys got up early in the morning and they sweep 4 blocks around. All of the garbage is not there anymore. You know, and everybody's saying, "Wow, something different, you know? Yeah, it's clean."
Singer and songwriter Ritchie Havens.
I could feel it, you know. It's something that we all was waiting for. It's just like Obama being elected, you know, or Kennedy being taken away from us. So we had very much a genuine experience of our times back then. And I expect on the 40th is going to be probably 2,000 festivals saying, "We want to be a part of this by just being somewhere," you know, where it's like, we're in a great time.
It rained a lot in Bethel, New York, on the weekend of the festival.
There was water on the stage, and the microphones weren't grounded. So when the vocalists were going up to the microphones, they would get shocks. They would go, bang.
Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart.
The stage was collapsing, they said. Too many of our friends were on it, jumping up and down. And people were screaming, "Get off the stage, it's going to collapse." You know, half of the PA went out. It was a frightening experience on stage for us.
Chew Chip Monk ran the production and stage design.
One of my production people thought it would be a good idea to get rid of the rain that had accumulated in this one piece of canvas. It was over the downstage center area where you would perform as a principal. Well, normally what you'd do is push it up in the center by a 2x4 or, you know, anything that you could find that could reach that piece of fabric. Well, unfortunately, this guy had a better idea. He taped his penknife to the end of a stick and cut a hole in the middle of it. And you wonder why Joe Cocker looked like he did? The entire contents on Cocker. I'm not sure whether that enhanced, helped, or degraded his performance.
How do I feel at the end of the day?
I said, because you're on your own.
I tell never you say no more.
Jimi Hendrix closed the festival with a set at 9 a.m. Monday, August 18th, 1969. Fornatel wrote Back to the Garden, the story of Woodstock.
As good as the first part of the set was, there was nothing in any of it to suggest what was about to come next. Without any warning, your ears tell your brain that you're hearing the opening notes of one of the most familiar, one of the most played, one of the most sung songs in the nation's history, the Star-Spangled Banner. Your ears are also telling your brain that, depending on your politics, you are hearing one of the most profane or one of the most profound versions of that song that you have ever heard. It is searing, it is soaring, it is stirring, it is majestic, it is mocking, it is shocking, it is appealing, it is appalling, it is calming, it's alarming. It is Jimi Hendrix playing the Vietnam War on the strings of his white solid body electric guitar with taps thrown in for good measure.
The film, which turned out to be one of the biggest films for Warner Brothers that year and probably still the biggest grossing documentary ever, was an afterthought.
Joel Rosenman co-produced the Woodstock Festival.
It seemed like such an imaginary idea until we got much closer to the festival. And when I say much closer, I mean Wednesday of that week. Same old story for Woodstock.
Ow, I can't turn you loose. If I do, I'm gonna lose my mind. Can't never turn you loose. If I do, I'm gonna lose my mind.
The documentary, Woodstock, released in 1970, and singer-songwriter Richie Havens saw its effect far and wide.
I went to South America, to Rio, and the movie had just come out there. In 1 week later, they had their own Woodstock, and it was bigger than ours. They just went for it, you know.
Over the years, many Woodstock-inspired festivals appeared. According to festival co-producer Joel Rosenman, Woodstock helped close the proverbial generation gap, for a while anyway.
The older generation watched kids get together in mud, chaos, disarray. And there was a lot of tut-tutting about it and how wasn't this just like the younger generation. And I think the New York Times called it Nightmare in the Catskills.
I said people think because my daddy did these things. They say that I've got to wear a tie and gonna be the same.
But very soon after that, the same event was characterized as a miracle at Bethel. The difference was that the older generation watched the younger generation pull itself together. They built a community. That community functioned. It took care of itself. It took care of its neighbors. It was responsible to all of the needs that arise in more or less difficult circumstances. The older generation was impressed that this younger generation, which they had previously thought maybe didn't have the maturity or the wisdom or the consideration for others, they suddenly felt this was a generation worthy of respect, and they started listening to what that generation had to say. I think there was a new respect on both sides, both generations, and a new exchange of ideas that led to some pretty significant changes in the 1970s.
The material on this podcast was adapted from the Woodstock Podcasts, produced by Joyride Media and posted by Andy Kahn on podcasts.legacyrecordings.com.